Hello and a very warm welcome to all of you on Emotional Years with Prateek. Very warm welcome to you, Rama. It's indeed a pleasure to have you here. Guys, with us, we've got Advocate Rama Sarodev, who's a very renowned advocate for as a lawyer, as a social activist, as a multifaceted personality who's been there as a posh consultant to various companies, to law support person for transgender community, sex workers, and endless. Her achievements have been endless to talk about. Rama, let us understand your journey so far, where all it has been and where all it's going to, it's taking you.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. Well, my journey has been enriching in all sense, even from a very personal point of view, I would say. I had never thought of law as a career, actually. And happened to come here probably just by elimination that, okay, what do you want to do? What will have a scope to work on? And as I entered the field is where I realized that I want to work with people.
Yep.
So that's when I started exploring what are my avenues and what can I do. And I got introduced to the whole civil society sector, NGOs, people working on different issues that matter, and that's what interested me. And when I started exploring that area, I further learned that, women and children are even more vulnerable within the various communities, or rather we would look at people in the society. And I said, probably this is where I need to focus my work. And so I've been working with women from different areas. I've worked in the prison. I have worked with sex workers. I've worked with the LGBTQIA+ community. I've worked with women facing domestic violence. Because I also work with men. Because when we talk of women's issue, we have to work with men as well. And so now I'm working on preventing sexual harassment at workplace, worked on child sexual abuse. So it just goes on.
That's what Advocate Rama Sarodev is known for, going on and on with various activisms, be it civil society, be it part of social activism, be it LGBTQ support community or sex workers community, offering them all the education, prevention of sexual harassment, so on and so forth. Now, my first question to you, Rama, is we see whenever something happens, especially we spoke about child sex abuse or, in domestic violence, etc., that element of violence or that element of abuse has a lot of deep emotional scar in the minds of people. And it's much deeper, and it takes much longer for them to heal this. And this is where once an aggrieved party often becomes revengeful. And people do not distinguish between revenge and justice, and justice and judgment. How do you look at it? I'm sure you would be facing a lot of people who come with aggrieved mindset, with a lot of anger in them, saying that he's hit me so bad, or, I was a victim of child sex abuse, and now this is where I'm at full of anger, and I really would like to go and kill that person, or I really would like to take my revenge out.
Yeah. So maybe not in such powerful words, but somewhere behind the mind, they do tend to mix up the two, like you said, that what does justice mean to them, and is the word justice, a synonymous with revenge? And I would say, since I work in the space of family law, it is true of everybody who's hassled with that relationship, be it a man or be it a woman, because both these people come to me. And so obviously when such cases get discussed, there will be a subjectivity because it's their perception of what has happened with them. And sometimes in that perception, the reality is blown out of proportion to create that perception also. So much so that they can't see the other person's point of view. And sometimes I play the devil's advocate, you know, that yes, I mean, you're my client and I'm here to hear you out. So vent out, I'm okay. All the anger that you have, whether it's a man or a woman or their family members, sometimes because they get pulled into all the fights that are happening. So they went out, but then I have my own way of asking them questions and, you know, getting things out of them. There, they do come to a realization that what exactly is it that I want? And that's the clarity that they should have. And I try to probe them in a way that they get that clarity that, okay, this is what I want. Taking them to the specifics of what is it that they want. And then talk about the options that are there that will be less traumatic and less painful for them, because at the end of it, it's a court battle.
And in court, you get judgment. Sometimes you get justice.
Yeah.
How would you define it?
So, well, because I deal in family matters, my approach is to look at, you know, okay, is this what you want? I mean, if you want separation, if that's what you want, then let's try and do it amicably. You know, let's talk to the other party. And sometimes the party that's coming to me thinks that, oh, the other party is just not approachable. They will just not listen to you. You know, I will say, okay, let's give it a chance. What's for us to lose? I mean, there's always a 50% chance that they may agree to what we're saying. And there's a 50% chance that we come back to status quo. But what's there to lose? You know, so let's approach. And I always encourage them to approach first rather than getting in a lawyer to intervene. You know, because the minute you say I'm a lawyer talking to you, you know, they may just close their minds to even have that conversation. But I train my clients that this is how you need to approach. If you want to settle things amicably, bring down the allegations and show them that there is a space for dialogue. You know,
very important. The dialogue is something that breaks the barriers between two people. That makes them more approachable, address their emotions, and also understand the other side of the story. Now, when you say that, you know, you talk to them to have a dialogue, etc., I'm sure it's very difficult and emotionally traumatic experiences for them. Something like somebody who's abused me all these years in my marriage, you're still asking me to patch up with him? Or somebody who's really been unreasonable with me and you're still asking me to go and sort it out with him? Come on, I have hired you as a lawyer.
Yeah.
Now, when these things come up and where you say that the solution is much easier than you think otherwise, how do people react?
Well, it's a very mixed reaction, I would say. But what I do is I give them a lot of space and I hear them out first. And when I hear them out, I kind of also understand what could be the possible approach. And so I discuss it step by step with them that, okay, this could be the first step. Is this possible? You know, because I have to validate it from them. This could be the second stage, you know. And if this doesn't work, this is the plan B. If this doesn't work, this is the plan that we will have. And ultimately, when you've exhausted all your options, then they will at least not point out to say, see, in the first instance, you sent a lawyer and spoke to us. You know, and that's where my role will come. And I said, I will intervene at the right time. If your efforts don't work, I will intervene. But I'm giving you that space in the family to involve the family to have those dialogues first. And it's okay not to stay together when, you know, you just can't stay amicably or there is a lot of incompatibility, it's impacting your children, then it's better that you part ways and co-parent rather than, you know, stick into that relationship just for the sake of sticking into that relationship. So that's fine. And if you really want to give this relationship a chance, then I will say that you need help. And I will suggest that you take help from, you know, people who do relationship coaching. You know, rather than you saying that I'll try and sort out my own problem, because it's just like, you know, you have cold and you try to get some medicines on your own and it's not helping. Ultimately, you need a doctor to diagnose what exactly has happened. So the relationship also needs to be diagnosed and you should go to somebody who can do it. So you think of all these options before coming to a lawyer. I give them all these options. And only when you are very sure that divorce is what you want, you come to me, because these processes are mostly irreversible.
Yeah.
You know, so I the first instance I ask them, what is it that you want? Do you want to go back and work this relationship out? Do you want me to help you there? Or do you want to separate?
So giving the space and making them understand their own viewpoint in a manner where you are presenting or you are enabling solutions for them. Okay? On a lighter note, Rama, this is not something that a wealthy lawyer is supposed to be doing.
Right. Please pardon me for saying that, but a wealthy lawyer is supposed to advise that out of these, we can really book the other person into A, B, C, 3 charges, 4 charges, 5 charges, and then fight out the case. Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I can do that if that's really necessary. But yeah, I can say I'm wealthy in other ways, that I have the blessings of people who have helped. So yeah, it may not always be in the form of money. So I mean, and I'm okay with that, because the whole approach that is important and that needs to be established is that it has to be a client-centric approach. It can't be what lawyers want. The solution is always with them. It's just that you need to facilitate the process to help them explore those solutions rather than tell them what they have to.
Lovely. So what you're saying is the answer lies within, just that it needs that exploration. Awesome. This is what we coaches normally do in our coaching sessions. Whenever we talk about, you know, any particular roadblock that people are not able to resolve. Now, LGBTQ activism has been on for last decade or so, more prominently so, for a decade and a half, etc. But you've been in this space for quite some time, isn't it?
Yes.
So how is it they get a feeling of alienation, they come to you to talk about, or how they are harassed by people, or somebody who they do not see them as a fit in the community, and they just come in and, you know, there's a lot of aggrieved, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of you know, disappointment that they come with.
Yeah.
So how do you normally go about supporting such people who are full of disappointment with the society's approach, with a lot of anger, saying that this society does not accept me because I do not fit into the conventional norms, and just because I have a little different sexual orientation or preferences, or I'm born differently and have hormonal changes in my body, I'm not being accepted. So how do you normally?
My own belief, and I would say that this is not because I'm in this space, it's been there in my family that we never really distinguished people because of their identities, whether it is the identity of sex or gender or status in the society or religion or caste. It didn't matter. I must tell you that my grandmother was a doctor, my mother is a doctor, and both of them have had run a maternity home that was mainly where, you know, people who could not afford the big hospitals, and they came to our maternity home. And growing up, I have seen my mother, my grandmother dealing with, families who would say, there's a daughter born and we are not interested. And my grandmother or my mother would say, we'll take care of her. Don't worry. I mean, she's like a Lakshmi who's come to your house and you don't want. And I've seen this discrimination, and probably, I was irritated, frustrated, but didn't know how to express it back then because probably I didn't have the same understanding. But I've seen this happen. But we never had this whole discrimination ever, because all kind of people would come to the hospital. And as a kid, I would just be excited to go and see that newborn baby. And yet, here are the issues that, the woman faced when all this happened. And so that whole inclusive culture, or that there is diversity in the society and we have to behave without discriminating, or it must show in our conduct, that we don't discriminate. I have seen that growing up. it's not like something that I had to really work on myself to accept it. I have seen that in my family, you know, and so it was not very difficult for me to go with this idea that, yes, there is diversity. People will have different identities and they're all part of the same community. They are part of the same society. So why should there be, discrimination based on the different identities that people have? Why do we look at everything in binaries of male and female? You know, we need to expand that. Probably I got a better understanding when I started working in the field, when I actually interacted with them, when I actually got to know what is it that they face, you know, in terms of discrimination, in terms of violence, in terms of how people treat them. And so I think it came very naturally for me to be a part of all of that. I can never say that the experience will be the same. I mean, of course, I've not lived their life, so that experience is not going to be the same. But empathy towards, them came very easily. I didn't really have to work too much because I didn't have any bias against any of this.
How you see society being biased all through and, you know, while working with these individuals, you only can say that I'm not biased, but they face a lot of challenges of biases and discrimination. And when they come to you, what's the advice that normally you give them to support?
Where we have to fight a legal battle, we have to fight the legal battle. And I don't see that, you know, the laws also support them very well. But then the fact that they have a right to live a dignified life and they don't get that dignity is something that we need to fight. So depending on what their issues are, we provide them with whatever legal assistance that we can. But talking of society, I think we all have our own unconscious biases. And they come from the beliefs that we have. They come from the values that we have. They come from, you know, our whole upbringing and, you know, what has been around us. What is it that growing up, what is it that we've seen? How have we seen people around us behaving? And then someday we are modeling what's happening around us, right? And so those biases will always be there. If not for this community, as it changes, maybe for something else and something else. Those unconscious biases will always be there. But I think the first step to it is to recognize, oh yes, this is a bias and I need to change it. That's where the journey for every individual will begin if we really want to bring that change. And so I'm a big follower of Mahatma Gandhi's "Be the change that you want to see in the world." It starts with you. You know, so instead of saying that you do this, it starts with you. So you let people model you then, but it has to begin with you.
Now in legal fraternity that we've seen, you know, with the recent case in Badlapur or Arjikar in Kolkata, we've seen that there's a lot of anger against the predators. And often that anger pushes people to go on either for mob lynching kind of a thing or with a lot of, extrajudicious killing for that matter. And people start justifying those. Now, how serious a threat of such emotional outbursts that you see coming up for the society? Because, you know, it's like everybody takes the law in their hands. They make kangaroo courts every way. And then it's a complete banana republic. So how do you see this?
I think that, the first principle that we learn when we enter the law school is that ignorance of law is not an excuse. Nobody can say, I don't know the law, right? And even as lawyers, we don't know all the laws, right? Now, when we say that ignorance of law is not an excuse, the question that comes to my mind is, whose responsibility is it to ensure that people know about the law? You know, educating people about the law. And hence, I would say that, you know, it is also such sensitive matters are also politicized to an extent where, you know, people start demanding for instant justice, that here's where we want this person to be hanged in front of us. It's not that they do not have the sense or the maturity to understand that this does not happen. There is a process to be followed. every department has a job given to them and they can only work within, you know, that jurisdiction or rather, you know, the job description that they have. So police or people at large cannot be the people to decide what the punishment should be. It's the court that will decide. You know, so this whole instant thing of this is where we want it, this is how we want it, they forget that there could be bigger crimes that can come out when there is a process that is followed. They forget that there could be a lot of people involved who are not yet coming in front of us that could, you know, be named if a process is followed. But when we start asking for instant justice and without following the process, is where actually it's not justice. It's at the justice is actually denied in a way, or we're doing away with justice and, you know, getting into the space that's not really going to give us long-term solutions to deal with the issues.
So in emotional intelligence, we always say that instant gratification is dangerous. So this is nothing but an instant gratification. What I see as somebody from emotional intelligence, industrial psychology background is, there's a lot of violence hidden in the society that comes out very often when such instances happen. And then that violence is getting justified. So not that whatever we see externally is a violence. There's a lot of hidden violence which often erupts in such ways. When people get extremely emotional, overwhelmed and excited, angered, etc. I'm sure there were instances during your law career that you might have faced. So let us discuss a couple of such instances where, you know, people were very, very aggrieved and were outraged, and then they came out very strongly saying that we need this. And then as a lawyer, you had to tell them, and still, you know, by and large, the justice was kind of only to pacify the immediate instant gratification or, you know, and any kind of an instant justice, so forth.
Yeah, I mean, in the court, I think people will look at it as winning a case or losing a case. But I think there is a lot beyond that. You know, it's not just about winning or losing a case, because sometimes I think that you have won a case. But if I look at it, what has my client got ultimately? You know, has it given them happiness as an end value? Are they happy with the result? And they've not been happy, you know, because what they expected and what they've really got as a reality. I mean, probably they got what they expected, but when the reality hits them, they know, oh, this is not going to really work. I've got it, but you know, it's not really going to work. Like,
again, this is not something that I imagined that it's...
Yeah, no, that is what they wanted. Like in one case, I was telling a client that, see, your husband doesn't want to stay with you. It's so evident, you know, and marriages can't really be forced. So why don't you allow us to, you know, negotiate and talk with him so that you get what is rightfully yours? And, you know, you move out of this relationship and look at things beyond this relationship. And she was so stuck with this whole thing that I've been married only for a few months and I do not want to think of a divorce. And finally, it's client autonomy for me. I have to fight the case like my client wants me to fight. And we actually won the case. And the court says, I don't see any reason why a divorce should be granted. I said, there, you've got it. Now, do you think you can go and stay with your husband?
Oh, yeah.
And that hit her, because for 4 to 5 years, she's been fighting him in the court. He's making allegations. She's making allegations. Both are fighting their own cases. She's got what she wants. But can you really implement it? Now can you go and stay with your husband? The court has said there's no reason for a divorce to happen. And that hit her. And then she said, yeah, probably not. I can't go and stay with him after 5 years of fighting.
So the outrage was replaced by...
Yeah, so technically she had won the case. Technically, I had won the case as a lawyer. But it didn't mean anything to me because I knew the reality would hit her later. You know, so it's not so much about winning. I always tell them that keep the control of the case with you. And that control is with you when you create a space for dialogue. Then it's a win-win situation. Create that space for win-win situation for both of you. You know, but at least try and create that space for win-win situation where you can take control of your life through using that space of dialogue.
Enabling the solution. Okay.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So this really tells us about the way you're concerned about overall sense of justice versus the reality. Yeah. Something like an illusion that I can live on, say that I open the case, but the question is that the end result that I wanted? Now, you know, you've gone through various instances, etc. You fought cases for LGBTQ community or rape victims and so on and so forth. Tell me the most emotionally difficult case for your own self, the way you fought it.
Well, there have been so many cases that I can narrate. But there's one case that I wouldn't say that, yes, we fought the case. But I think what came out, or rather, you know, creating an opportunity is what I looked at. The whole thing about when you believe in something and when you're telling others that this is how it should be, have you done anything about it? You know, like I said, that have you been the change? You know, that whole thing matters a lot to me, that it should just not be a talk. You should walk the talk. You know, so while I was working in the prison, I met a lady, you know, who was there for murdering her husband. And when I spoke to her, she said that she was a victim of domestic violence. And her husband used to, you know, drink a lot of alcohol. He would take the money that was at home. She was earning, her son was earning, her younger son, who should have probably been in the 7th or the 8th grade, was also earning, you know, left school and they were earning. And this man would, when he didn't find any money, he would even sell the utensils at home and, you know, create a ruckus, but he needed money for the alcohol. Now, one fine day when he came home, the younger son and she were at home and the older one had gone for work. And because there was no money to give him, he got so mad and he was so angry that he started biting the hand of her son. And that's where the mother in her, you know, wanted to protect the son. So she just pushed him aside and he fell down and he was unconscious. Now, she got scared because he was unconscious. So she and her son took him to a hospital. And, you know, by the time he went to the hospital, he was dead. And she herself went to the police station to inform the police that this is what happened and now he's dead. So you know that the intention was not really to kill him, but to save the child. But will the law look at it that way? So the police made the younger son the complainant and the mother was made the accused in the case. And so she was sent to the prison. And then we went and took her case and, you know, we were helping her. We were providing legal aid and we were helping her and we got her out on bail. And there was a journalist who wanted to do a story on women in prison. So she agreed to come and talk to the journalist. So we called her home and our son was about 9 or 10 months old back then. And we were looking for somebody to take care of our son. And I don't know what happened. It was in that instant moment kind of a decision. You know, where she was just telling the journalist that because of these accusations, I lost my job. I'm without the job. Nobody will take me unless this case clears. And I know that it will take a long time for this case to clear. So I just called Asim aside and I said, what is your gut feeling? Do you think we should hire her to look after our son? And he was also shocked with that kind of a question coming out of the blue. And he said, yeah, why not? So I said, okay. So after the interview, I asked her, I said, you don't have a job is what you're saying. And you stay about 2 hours far from my place. But do you think you can come and take care of my son? And we didn't have too many meals back then. We had just started with our career. So I told her that this is how much I can pay you. I know it's not sufficient, but at least it will give you a job and probably we can further give work with us. And she accepted that instantly. And there were other people in the family when they got to know that, you know, this is a lady I've met in the prison. She's accused of murder. And now I'm leaving a son who can't even speak with her the entire day that I'll be out working. They were shocked. And they said, how can you do this? I mean, don't you love your son? Do you want to... They already had labels for her. You know, I said, yeah. I said, let me give her a chance. I care about my son. I know what I'm doing. It's just a gut feeling that she's a nice lady. And she worked with me for about 4 years. And then I had my relatives asking, hey, do you have somebody like her who can also come and work for me?
So the stereotype changed too over the period of time.
And then since my son didn't need that help anymore, we were able to give a reference and she was able to get another
job.
Sure. So you have to believe in giving a second chance. You can't be just labeling people for what they acted in that moment. You know, of course, we have to distinguish them between the hardened ones and the, people who live only to do offense. Those are different. But there are nice people in the society and act out because of the circumstances that they have been in. And so we can't label them as offenders forever, as criminals forever. We need to believe in giving people
a fair chance. So it was situational and then he wrote back rather than stereotyping. What a brave, brave step, Rama. I must congratulate you and Aseem for actually making it happen, walking the talk and, you know, leading by example. Now, I'll come to the second aspect of law, and you know, you've been into human rights activism. Normally in our country, human rights activism are always looked upon with certain suspicion. All right, now they're labeled all across, and I don't want to talk about the names that they give, but then at times doesn't it disturb you saying that, hey, look, we are also serving the country in the right manner, where human development, human rights are equally important than being tough or appearing to be tough, so to put. So whenever such instances would come, I'm sure, let us talk about certain instances where as a human rights activist, you face the wrath of the people and they called you names and you know, it was very difficult for you to overcome such things.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of, portrayal of human rights activists that is done, even in films, and, you know, they are the ones who are nuisance creators kind of a thing. And people like me face even more difficult situations because we're particularly focusing on working on women and child rights. So, women activists will be looked at even differently. The way they show in the serials and the way they show in the movies, it's like the only job that they have is to go and blacken somebody's face, which is absolutely not what we do, you know. So I think they need to realize that what are we talking about at the end of it? When we say that we are working on the issues of human rights, what are we talking about? We are talking about life. We are talking about dignified life. We are talking about everybody getting their rights. And, if that doesn't matter to us, what else will matter? Aren't we all fighting for that? Isn't that the basic that we must get as, you know, human beings? So that's all, like, if you have to simplify it so much, you know, and then we are working across sectors, whether it is based on communities or caste or religion or identities or gender. So we are just working across all those verticals and we are talking, hey, this group is affected because of the caste. This group is affected because of religion. This group is affected because of gender. You know, but they are affected because of the identities that they have. And hence we are saying that they shouldn't be, right? I mean, they should just live like any other normal life that you and I live. And that's all that activists are really talking about working towards if we really have to simplify it, right? That realization that we all have, equal protection of life law. When we say that, yeah, we all have a right to live a dignified life. And if somebody's not getting it because of a particular identity or a particular community that they belong to, how is that acceptable? How can that be acceptable? It shouldn't be acceptable for anybody. So I think for me, how is civics taught in school is where you're shaping our citizens. If you give them that sense while you are teaching, because civics is not a subject where you teach them because you want to score something out of 40 marks. It is a way of life. And that's how it should be taught. And that's probably a subject that is given least importance, although it's a way of life.
True.
And I think we need to change that.
Creating the right citizens is what civics should be targeted at.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody will become a human rights activist. We don't have to. That becomes everybody's identity then.
Right. So often, you know, human rights activists are also blamed as someone who's anti-progress, anti-growth, anti-development, and who are spending a lot of time in terms of delaying the development of the country, growth, so on and so forth. Has there been an incident where, because of this humane approach, that you were labeled or you were looked upon as somebody who's trying to delay or trying to create nuisance, so on and so forth?
Absolutely. We get all those labels. The question here is, the development is at what cost? Is your development sustainable? You know, and if it is going to benefit everyone, it has to be sustainable.
True.
Why are we talking of climate change so much now?
True.
You know, why are there checks and balances put for everything that we do in the name of development? You know, can we say that we will kill a community and then say we want to do something by killing a community and that is development? Can that be justified?
Definitely.
It cannot be. So nobody is against development. It's how you do that development.
Whether it is inclusive.
Whether it is inclusive, whether it is sustainable, you know, whether it is you can't create the nature. If I have to just give a very simple thing, it's there. You have to respect it. But if you do something that's going to destroy the nature, it's going to show its wrath, and it's already showing us in so many ways.
So any incident where, you know, you were kind of troubled because of this human approach that you had?
Well, directly, I have not been involved in any such case that can, hit me directly. But yes, Asim has been involved, and, you know, because he works on environment matters, and he works on so many issues. The best part is that I don't litigate. I mean, I do the training part. So it's very easy.
This is very rare to find a lawyer saying that the best part is I don't litigate. All right. When Asim came to our podcast, he had a different view.
He takes the brunt of the frustration more than I do. I have the best of two worlds, where I see what is happening in the court, I see what is happening in the systems, I see what is happening in the people, because that's where my core area of work is. And I can take those learnings back, and as a trainer, I can go to these people who are in the system and say, hey, this is what you can do differently, this is what is happening there, you know, and I can show them the mirror and say that, hey, can you do this differently? So in a way, you know, I get to see the best of both worlds, where I can go and communicate with them, I can go and contact them, and I can tell them that this is what you can do. And how I can tell them this is what you can do is because I have the experience of working with the people in the field. So I know what their issues are. So, and that's why I said that I'm in a very comfortable position as a lawyer, that, you know, I don't go to the court, so that whole frustration that is there in that field, I don't get to experience that, although I know that, but doesn't mean that it's less frustrating for me. So when somebody still comes with the same old issue of violence and rape and, you know, child sexual abuse, and we've been dealing with it for 24 years and it goes on, there's no end to it, at some point it is taxing. At some point, it is very frustrating that, you know, where is this going to change? And how are we going to change?
I'm sure these would be experiences full of emotional turbulence. Right.
Yeah.
How do you keep your own emotions in check?
So,
you will, by example, so I ask you.
So, earlier I would get involved emotionally. It would trouble me. I couldn't sleep. And there are still some cases that trouble. At the end of it, we're human beings. So it's going to impact. right? There's something that comes out from our past. It's some repressed memory that, oh, this also happened with me. I don't remember about it now, but you know, it did happen. So it's happening since then, kind of a realization that comes. But over the years, I think I've learned to dissociate and I've learned to accept this, that people will come to me when they are in trouble. They will not come to me when everything is okay. That is why they're coming to me. I have to be prepared. You know, they're coming to me for a solution, because I'm not going to give them the solution, but I'm going to give them, these are your options. You choose your solution. I'll help you there.
Enabling their solution.
Yes. So once I accepted this fact that people will come to me only when they have problems, they are not going to come to me when there are no problems. You know, I was able to dissociate and look at myself as a professional who does not have to be emotionally involved in
their problems.
Right. And I have to look at it very neutrally. I have to look at it like an outsider. And yet be empathetic towards what they are saying. Yet be non-judgmental when they're sharing something. I have to maintain my ethics, confidentiality. So even when a family member comes and tells me something, other members in the family don't know what they've told me. That's the level of confidentiality that I will maintain. Because they have not come to me because I am their niece or I am their relative. They've come to me as a professional. And I have to bring in that professionalism to, you know, maintain that kind of a distance in a way that has to be there. However, I will still say that there are certain cases that disturb you. You can't really be so aloof from what is happening. So even reading a news at times can impact you. It doesn't have to be a real case that you're handling. But yeah, I try to do that, and I will definitely say that neuro-linguistic programming, my training in neuro-linguistic programming has helped me understand this matter.
Yes, it does. I mean, I have undergone that myself, so I understand what you're saying. Now, my question here is, you know, and of course, this is something that I'd like to add as well, is unfortunately in India, people feel that empathy is getting emotionally involved, which it is not. Empathy is putting yourself in the other person's shoes and thinking and feeling like he does during that particular situation, understanding and then collaborating and, you know, then continuing with the dialogue. You've been on the posh committee of various companies, right? As a lawyer, as a consultant, so on and so forth. What has changed in sexual harassment at workplace post-Vishakha guidelines? I'm sure we all understand that before Vishakha guidelines, there were inappropriate behaviors in corporates, which were absolutely, regarded, or which were exploited because of the position of power or so on and so forth. Post that, over the period of years, what's your observation? Because sexual harassment first starts with a power dominance, which itself is an emotion of aggression.
So, yeah, Vishakha changed. It was a landmark judgment, I would say. Vishakha bridged in the gap of a no-law situation when it came to sexual harassment at workplace to bringing a system where you can report. But of course, there were a lot of people who did not follow Vishakha, and the need for the law was there, and which we got in 2013. From that, I think at least a few who did not follow having that system in their office now think that, oh, it's a compliance. So even though it's a tick box activity for them, they're still complying with it. Not that that's a great way to do it. At the end of it, when I talk to people in the organization, and especially the decision makers in the organization, I said, what is it that matters to you at the end of it? Is it the return on investments? Okay. Is the ROI? Yeah, it's the ROI that matters to you. Is it only the business that is getting you the ROI? Or is it creating that enabling culture that will get you that? If you have employees who are happy at work, where they spend the most time, isn't that what you want as an outcome of all this at the end of it? Only then will they be productive. And then one way of doing it is prevention of sexual harassment. That's only one way of doing it.
True.
Right? So it's not just about ticking a box and saying I'm aware of the law. it's not just about having a committee in place and conducting trainings. You know, it is about what is the kind of culture that you want to bring in for them. It is about, are your employees aligned with the values of your organization? Are you able to do that? And if they are aligned with the values of your organization, they will know to behave responsibly. And if they know how to behave responsibly, then they will not do anything to, you know, create a situation where someone says that my right is violated because I was sexually harassed. So it's a bigger thing, and there's more in prevention and prohibition than in redressal. So if you invest more in taking those preventive measures, you know, you will not lose out on good employees.
The right culture will remain.
Absolutely. And that is what Bosch is about. It's not about punishing somebody. I don't believe in that. It's about, like I said, I don't believe in the fact that, you know, you have to label people as criminals, as offenders. I believe in giving people a chance. And sometimes some of those acts are not even, you know, intentional. Some of them come because of their own belief system. Some of it comes because of the cultural context that they have been in, you know, and they are looking at it from their perspective. Do we need to change that perspective? If it's harming somebody else, yes, we need to do that. And that's the correctiveness that we need to bring in. So I believe in corrective measures. I believe in saying that, yes, you've done this wrong. We need to take an action. But this is for you to understand that the situation should not aggravate. This shouldn't happen again. My concern is that it shouldn't come up as a repeat offense. You know, and that's what I focus on when I work on prevention of
sex. Most of these acts, most of these laws, most of these acts are very, very female-centric is what normally people start believing in. And
they are
also results in people not being very open, extra careful while conducting themselves at work. And yet, the culture also suffers because of the fear of being punished on this.
Yes, they are women-centric for a reason. And the reason being that women do face a lot of discrimination, you know, at work, at home, in public space. And these are affirmative actions that the law allows. You know, so, but that doesn't mean, and I don't believe that, especially when we are talking of workplaces, that, you know, workplaces should be safe for everyone is my belief.
True.
Irrespective of gender. You know, it has to be safe for everyone. But the law is gender specific for a reason. That's because of the spike in the number of cases that women have faced, you know, as sexual harassment. Look at the recent Justice Hima report. How many men are saying that they were sexually harassed in the Tollywood? Nobody's saying that. It's all the women, whether they are big stars or, you know, glamorous people, they are still vulnerable. And they're still saying that, you know, there is a power dynamics when it comes to, you know, men as actors and men as directors and women as actors and women as directors. There's still that power dynamics that we can't deny. And so many of them said that we lost work because we came out in the open to say that we were harassed. So if this is the level of discrimination and it is reflecting on the gender gap report of our country, we need to do something about it. So it is not so much about, you know, why is it that only women are protected? Yes, workplace has to be safe for everyone. And there are means of even handling cases. If men have to report a case, it is through the internal policies of the organization. Because broadly, it's a misconduct. I have handled cases of men being harassed by other men. I have handled those kind of cases also. I have handled cases of women harassing women. But the majority of cases are about men harassing women. And that, I think, sometimes also becomes like an accepted thing. Well, it's happening for so many years and, you know, it will happen. We take this very casually. But why should it happen? I mean, why can't we change it?
At times, even these things are misused, right?
Yes. I mean, which law is not misused? Every law is misused, unfortunately. But that's not the objective of the law. There's no law that comes with an objective that, you know, this is made for you to misuse.
True.
Every law is misused. Yeah, like we jump the red signal and go. That's a misuse of law. Right? So any law is misused, although that's not an objective. But under this particular law, there is a provision that says that, you know, if there is a false or a case made with malicious or frivolous intentions, there will be punishment for such a person. So there are provisions for checks and balances. It's not like, you know, that misuse will be allowed. It shouldn't be. I don't believe in misusing.
But the social taboos are bigger than the
yes.
And that's where it takes a backseat. All right. So I'm sure you might have come across a lot of instances where, because of social taboos, despite of domestic violence, people would still want to continue with their respective spouses and go on. Okay. Whenever we say that, at times, you're a divorce lawyer, so I always say that people look at divorce in a very negative light. Whereas I look at it as an exercise of your sense of freedom from an unwanted or a toxic relationship. So what would change people's perspective of moving away from the social taboos, be it rape victim, be it LGBTQ community, be it divorce law, or be it domestic violence, so on and so forth?
I think the clarity in what they want. If they have a clarity of what they want, what the ultimate outcome is, you know, then law just becomes a channel for them to get it.
Okay.
So getting that clarity is important, and that's exactly the kind of work that I try and do with my clients. That I ask them so many questions that, you know, they should get a clarity of what is it that they want. To take whatever time you want. I know these are not easy things. At the end of it, nobody marries saying that, oh, one day I will divorce. Nobody does that. It is traumatic. So even when you go through a mutual consent divorce where there's a lot of dialogue and, you know, amicable settlements and a win-win situation, it is still traumatic because you are parting ways.
True.
It is impacting two families. It is impacting children. So as a lawyer, what I try to do is facilitate the process in the way that it will not make it problematic for them later after they're divorced. Like, I've had cases even during the pandemic when we had filed them, but, you know, we couldn't complete them immediately because people were stuck in their places. They wouldn't come to the court to confirm. And all I told them was, please follow the settlement terms that we have drafted till you're able to finalize your divorce. And that smoothened matters for them, and that they were able to follow that in a way that, you know, it didn't impact children badly. They said, okay, if this situation comes up, okay, this is what we do. So I tell them, give all the options. If this happens, then this. If this happens, it may or may not happen. Let's put in all the provisions because we have to think of the future and then draft this. So it may not happen, but if you think this is a possibility, let's put that possibility there.
It has to have an agreeable framework.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great. So it was really, really nice and enriching knowing your work, knowing so many things about law, about various acts, the way you have looked at law. Okay, as I've said on a lighter note, I have seen a lawyer who says litigation is something that you need to avoid. And that's my biggest takeaway today from this talk, though. And you've shared all how you enable solutions. It was wonderful, wonderful talking to you. Before we wind up, before we end this discussion, I would like to, put across this. When you see the next generation coming here, they're taking up the judicial activism, social legal activism. What are the things that they need to be careful of? They need to be, in line to pursue something, some career that might shape up like you and us.
Well, the question that they need to ask themselves, and that's the kind of question that I have asked myself, that when I do something, who is it helping? Is it helping that last man? I go with Gandhiji's talisman. You know, is it contributing there? Is it helping there? So you can do whatever you want to do in whichever field you want to be. It's important that as a professional, you also balance your earning and supporting your family and being self-sufficient and live a good lifestyle and all of that. But I think it's equally important to give back to the society. And if you're able to balance between the two of being ambitious about your career and being able to give back to the society, I think there is a lot of sense of satisfaction there. You know, there is a lot of sense of happiness there. And I think that you just feel that it's fulfilled. You know, so I think you pursue, and that's true for every career. I think if you have the tendency to give back to the society, I think that is what ultimately matters.
Fantastic. So that was, that's on that note, let's end this. And as our tradition goes, okay, we're going to have a mug autographed by you. And I'm going to gift you one mug, which is autographed by
Lucky.
And this was lovely talking to you. And I'm sure my audience is enriched with a lot of understanding of law and its practices and what you do and how important it is to overcome these emotional battles. Lovely. Thank you very much. Can we have the mug? Now that's the one you're going to sign for us.
Sure.
Be the change. Says, that's one of my most favorite quotes, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm going to sign one.